This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. So we each come to tonight's discussion wearing multiple hats and multiple identities. We are art makers, we're educators, some of us have a social work kind of past. Some of us curate and direct institutions. So we each come with kind of multiple group identities. But we share an ardent and a continued commitment to reflecting on our roles and our responsibilities and our authority in Philadelphia and making Philadelphia a more progressive cultural landscape. I'm not going to ask everyone to speak tonight about particular work. They may choose to do so. Rather, the idea that we've convened under is the idea of really just trying to think together about how we're working, why we're working in the way that we're working. Again, not so much what we're doing, but the methodological underpinnings of the work that we're doing. And so again, the idea tonight was, on Roberta's and my part, and everybody at ArtBlog and Slot, was really to create a forum in which we could actively deliberate and reflect, and really kind of make that public, make that legible, that culture of reflection. So as Ken's Monuments Lab project poses, Philadelphia may be undergoing a possible revival right now. As Pepon's current project Reform reminds us, this progress meets a great deal of resistance from longstanding and unresolved civic and structural challenges. In just the past few years, along what we call the linear mile here at Slot, the 40th Street corridor that runs from the University of Pennsylvania at 40th and Locust to 40th and Brown and 40th and Westminster, we've witnessed just along those 10 blocks in the last few years the trauma of school closings, fluctuations in youth violence, rapid gentrification, and a pronounced and increasingly uneven distribution of resources and opportunities. So what is our role as artists, as curators, as organizers, and as institutions? To whom are we responsible? How and why? What role should history play in this conversation and in our own processes? We're delighted to have Amy here, of course, with us tonight as well, who comes to this conversation with a long history of advocacy as well, at Visual Aids and now at ICA. So with all these voices in mind, Roberta and I and everybody at Slot and ArtBlog were struggling to figure out like how to structure tonight's conversation. We felt that we should structure it, although maybe tonight we'll evade that structure and end up somewhere very different. But one of the ways we tried to do that was to enumerate a series of keywords, a series of like kind of, let's say, tensions or questions that are underlying a lot of the work that we're doing and a lot of the work that our communities are doing, and to use that as a structure for tonight's conversation. So again, we're trying to not structure tonight so much as an interview or as a series of kind of call and response, but rather as kind of an open-ended conversation prompted by particular words. That said, just one last kind of remark. As you guys know, we've foregrounded with the title for tonight's program three words: art, activism, and evangelism. We wanted to suggest that these three words are actually in a very intertwined kind of conversation right now in Philadelphia and historically as well. The pictures that were projected behind us before we began kind of speak to that long history of art, activism, and evangelism being in a really intertwined kind of mix in Philadelphia. I'm sure many of you are wondering, I think Pepon and Ken are also wondering, this question of why evangelism was in that kind of mix, in that triumvirate. We wanted to be provocative on one part, but we also wanted to explore the resonance of this term in a Philadelphia context. As many of you know, there's a long history of evangelism in this city. We could look to the Quakers, Richard Allen's African Methodist Episcopal Church, Thomas Paine's Common Sense, more recently in the cultural community, let's say the rhetoric of mural arts, which has a zeal to it, and Spiral Q as well, let's say. So we wanted to kind of like reflect on that culture of evangelism and see if there's some conscious or unconscious way that it's rubbing off in the cultural community. And then finally, all of us had kind of shared and we had put it online, Grant Kester's essay, Aesthetic Evangelist, that I'm sure we all have very different positions about, but that raises some critical questions about power dynamics in the cultural community and the tendency for artists to appoint themselves as representatives of the communities they engage. So that being said, I'm going to just start by, again, beginning with like the first question that at Slot and the ArtBlog that we had kind of developed this afternoon and in the weeks prior. And it may be the last question, or there may be more to follow, but we'll see. So the first question begins with kind of what I've just been speaking about. Everyday life in Philadelphia is so overdetermined, or at least in our perspective, is so overdetermined by a sense of history. One aspect that at Slott seems to be evident is a sense of isolation and a hunger for social interaction that you see in the city. And so I wanted to ask you guys to reflect on that and whether you have a similar reading of the city. And in particular, I wanted to ask you guys to talk about kind of the role that memory and history plays in your work. I'm thinking, Pepon, the first project I remember experiencing of yours was Casita for Congreso, where you literally built an architecture of community memory. Ken, I'm thinking of a project like Monument Labs that actively seeks to recover history in the city and think about how it informs and impacts present realities. So I guess that question about memory and history would hopefully get us going.
Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry, I'm giving you my bag, but this like this structure, I'm afraid to fall a bit. And I promise to be very serious, but I have to say that this whole evangelical thing, it's really interesting because I feel like I'm born again Puerto Rican myself. And it was a process of acculturation and also another process when I got to Philadelphia that I felt that there was already a definition of what that meant by Philadelphia in terms of people in North Philly. And I felt that little by little since 2000, I have been born again to be who I am as a Puerto Rican. But having said that, my interest is mostly about building on the landscape of memory that already exists and traveling through the landscape. And that's how I see myself in terms of connecting with the people that I've worked. So the majority of my work is basically building on a landscape of memory that already exists, whether it's civic or social.
Yeah. Well, I think history, when it's there's too much history in Philadelphia, right? And I don't mean too much history in the sense of you know, because any site has too much history, but there's too much reliance on history and too much interpretation of history and overdetermination of history, as you say. And when you do that, you actually straitjacket yourself. You start paralyzing yourself in terms of even understanding the present, right? I mean, I think about the kind of Nietzschean idea, right? Kind of classic, and it's of you know, uses and abuses of history from his book on observations and so on. And you know, he says, you know, if you have too much history, then you become enslaved to it, and you have no understanding of the present. But more importantly, you basically preempt the future. And I think that's real danger here in terms of relying too much on history. Of course, history is important because you need to learn from history, but not if you fetishize it in the, you know, what he called the antiquarian sense or the monumental sense.
Well, and I think speaking as an institution, or speaking for an institution, that being in Philadelphia, artists and artworks create a place to look at different types of history. So if the history of, you know, American democracy is what is represented in so many of the institutions and sort of that's what's built up around this city, the questions about the validity of that and the questions about the histories that are elided by promoting this over and over again is really fertile territory, I think, for art and artists. And something like an exhibition that just closed this week at ICAA, Traces in the Dark, really looks at three different artists from three different geographic and historic positions using different forms to recover history, and particularly through archives. So while something like Visual Aids is really using an archive in an activist way to create another line of history, one that would have totally been erased or will be erased, artists can also really kind of screw with the archive itself to make, I think, a little bit more of what Ken was talking about, this imagined histories, or the possibilities mm-hmm. of histories, or the possibilities of futures. And for me, that's always exciting.
Okay, so we also had a question about trust and distrust, like what role social trust plays in your work. Are you trying to enable trust through the work and overcome social distrust in society? Does your work require trust? Is distrust, on the other hand, a facet of everyday life and something you're trying to work with? Can you just talk about kind of what this word trust means to you, or what its resonances are?
I wanted to talk particularly about sort of like milestones that have been part of my process and my practice. And I just go back again to 1993 when I noticed that when I was trying to create and make was very different from what was being expected out there and with the people who were collaborating with me at that time in the South Bronx. So I'm not showing off. Half of a page of the New York Times was a work that I did in 1993, and I was very proud of it, and also disconnected to it. So immediately what I did is that I grabbed the New York Times and I went to my next door neighbor who had been working with me and showed it to her, and I said, look, the New York Times. And she knew the piece. She knew the work, right? But she looked at me and she said, what's the New York Times? And that's when I began to realize the disconnect that I was having in terms of that, of my practice. And so, having said that, I think that it's about an initiation process that I feel that I have to, in working with communities, I have to be initiated, I have to be witnessed, I have to be seen before even engaging into the process of it. And in that process of getting to know people and people opening up themselves, I have always believed, and to most of the students that I work with, it's about, for whatever story you've been told, you have to give a story back. Not to build trust and not to manipulate the situation, but rather find a common ground. And that's just basically for me. And it's also about accountability in many ways. For me, it's extremely important that the people that I've worked with in this neighborhoods and community know where I am, know where to get me, and know exactly how to get me. Because at some point, sort of a Greek gives a three-dimensional aspect to my practice. That's just me.
To be honest, I don't trust the question. because there's something metaphysical about it, in the sense of that there's a unifying sense of entrustment, which I don't trust. And I think for healthy, it's healthy for artists to. I don't work with some community in mind. I don't work in that way anyways. I'm not saying it's better or worse. I just don't work that way. I believe in spatial activism, or activation, let's say, as opposed to activism. I believe in projecting a communitarian dimension, perhaps, in the discourse of my work, but not necessarily particularized to some interaction with a community or even various communities and so on. So. Because I guess I don't even trust the word community, because I hear it all the time. I'm speaking for the community, and so on. And I always say, who gave you the right to speak for that community, and who's that community? And then all hell breaks loose at that point, right? So, I'll leave it there.
Good. So I wanted to respond to this, because I also don't trust museums and exhibition spaces, and so and I don't mean to be funny. I mean it's real, and so the question is that. I like where you're going, because for me it's about that very same of what I was talking about the New York Times. It's the recontextualization of my work in on the terms of a very specific institution, and I think that by working with outside of that structure, I feel that there is a greater interpretation of the work. And a contextualization that it feels somehow real for me. And so when I go to museums, I feel that there is a sense, or exhibition space for that matter, let's not just look at the museum, but I feel that there is a sense of, and I think this is really interesting, of a middle class attitude to it. And I had always been very much tensioned with that in terms of how do you represent that? and that sort of approach to the art from that place. And I think that it's, that to me, it's extremely important that the work is seen in the context of its environment where it comes from. And that's why I have chosen, I don't know if I've been very clear, but I have chosen to present work outside of the museums or exhibition space first as a way to create some sort of an entry of the people that have witnessed the process of making, you know, the installations and the work. And so that for me makes a little bit more sense. But in a way, you know, yeah, it's interesting. I just don't trust the museums. And I don't trust necessarily the art. There's multiple art worlds, but I don't trust the mainstream art world. There's something about it that I just feel very, somehow that I don't belong there.
Have you had successful projects inside arts institutions and museums? And have you brought an audience that was integral to the making of those pieces into those spaces?
The ICA.
Yes.
Yeah. Yay. Well, you know.
But it was a process of mm-hmm. to me, it's always a process of educating the staff,
the institution.
And the institution itself. Mm-hmm. Where I feel where I'm working in the neighborhood, there is mm-hmm. there's no reason to educate. It's always self-explanatory. And so, yeah. But the show at the ICA was a big exhibition, and it was one that we had to force engagement in a way that it wasn't, and it didn't feel natural to the ICA programming. You know,
and did really the audience change for that show at ICA?
Yeah. We have a lot of mm-hmm. caseworkers. We have judges mm-hmm. coming in from family. Yeah, all that. Yeah, and the participants. So yeah, in a way. But it was almost for them to come into a foreign place, mm-hmm. right? As mm-hmm. they saw the exhibition.
Well, and always interesting to sort of feel like they can occupy that space. It's an odd thing to say as a museum mm-hmm. director that I don't disagree with you, Pepon, that mm-hmm. I don't, you know, that I also distrust institutions, or I have an expectation that certain things are going to change when you put them in an institutional context. I also know that my institution currently, and the one that I used to work at, is really like a group of people working together to try and do something. So we have this history behind us at ICA that we're part of, this Ivy League institution that has been pushing into West Philadelphia, you know, for like decades and decades and decades, and has its own particular relationship to the city of Philadelphia and the citizens here. That all stands, and yet we're also 16 people, I think, with all different political and social agendas, and somehow our presence in the museum and our presence at events and the voice that you hear when you're reading something on the wall, or that whether you're reading in a publication or you're at an event or if you're just having a cup of coffee with us is personal. So I'm not absolving like a ICA, taking it out completely outside of an institutional context. But I still think of it sometimes just as a group of people.
I am interested in this notion of social economy in the very, you know, sociological sense, which was, I guess it was defined as this terrain vague between public space and private space, and public institutions and private institutions, especially in respect to what neither actually offers, right? And I think building from that point of view is healthy. That's the territory I like to engage in. A position of kind of skepticism to both dimensions, but seeing that it's impossible to not be implicated in either as well. So, and acknowledging that implication somehow.
Maybe I could ask you guys to actually stay on this question and build from it and build upon it. The question of institutions, of course, is something that impacts all of our work. We pass through them, we resist them, we evade them, we direct them. So what would be their ideal function? We've been talking, Pepon, you've been talking about how the communities you engage relate to them. But so how do they change? How do they not just change, but radically change? I'm thinking of a comment you made a long time ago on that Art 21 documentary, and I may be taking it out of context, maybe misremembering it, but I think you were talking about how change is not just something that we could talk about in visual terms, but it's something we should talk about in psychological, spiritual, physical terms. So how does an institution change in that way?
I guess the question was, I think that I wanted to go back again to the thing about the what I feel in an institution, and outside of the institution. To me, outside of the institution, my work becomes bigger than me, right? And the institution, and somehow I feel that that a lot of attention has been put in on me, you know, as an artist, an independent, as a practicing artist. And I think the institutions are little by little changing, but not at the pace that I see changes happening out there in sort of other dimensions and other places. And somehow I am beginning to feel a little bit, this is interesting because it's about distrustful, where I will be able to see the changes that I expect to see in institutions while I'm alive, you know? And so, yeah. I think it's happening slowly, and I think that it's also dependent on a lot of other factors that are resisting to the change, more so than out of those places.
So, Amy, what would be the ideal function, not necessarily of the ICA, but of an institution more generally?
Well, I mean, I think that cultural institutions are civic institutions, and civic institutions have a public responsibility. They should be public space. And what changes, you know, I think on behalf of somebody who works at a museum, thinking about what are the barriers for a wide variety of people coming to this institution who will change and make this institution, what can we do to remove those barriers? But I also put that back on some of my colleagues and viewers too. If you want to see those institutions change, then occupy them, then show up at their events, take over the conversations, push for these things. I think that we are presenting at ICA, just as I did at Visual Aids, as a really diverse platform of ideas and artists and histories, but to have the engagement move beyond, wow, this institution is really white, wow, this institution is really straight, requires, I think, some just like a groundswell of people willing to participate in a conversation. And I take that on our responsibility to remove those barriers and to understand it's not just because the institution is free, everyone feels free to come into it and everyone feels free to participate. But I also think that the possibility there, especially around these creative experiences, can be kind of an extraordinary place, and I hope that it can happen at places like ICA so that people outside of your traditional fine arts audience will also feel that same sense of ownership of places like the PMA and the understanding of a visual literacy, the understanding of a creative language will become part of their expectations for their society, and that, you know, the pleasure of spending that time contemplating these works, these histories, and the pleasure of spending time together discussing them will kind of radiate outwards. I mean, that's in the most ideal situation what I'm hoping will happen, what I, you know, see happening.
I guess it's my turn. Well, you know, Edward Manet was celebrated for his contributions to the Salon Le Refuge. And yet at the same time, he never stopped applying for the mm-hmm. Academy shows. Why? Because he thought he might get in. And I think that would be my attitude towards institutions. As an artist, you negotiate, knowing full well the pernicious aspects, whatever aspects you want in terms of institutions. I mean, institutions tend to territorialized smaller institutions with alternatives. They gobbled them up, right? And so, and they're also self-affirming, right? And which is, I think, dangerous. You know, in the 19, during conceptual art, you had a lot of artists who, you know, had as a kind of ideal, the idea of the dissolution of institutions and so on. I think that ideal should somehow still be maintained but it's diminuated since then. So I think even when I remember speaking to Hans Hacke, right? And you know, people are always posing the question, well, if you're so skeptical of institutions, why do you accept to be in the Venice Biennale? Why do you accept to be in Documenta? Right? Same answer as Manet, because I might get in, right? And that's my attitude towards institutions.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what I meant by change, and that it's that in institutions, and that it's that there is a reflection, some kind of a mirroring of what's happening outside of the institution, inside of the institution. That's what I mean. So then there is a sense of somehow balance between what's happening out there in here, right? And I see the disparities, and I also see the difference between those two as I walked into the institutions. And I'm talking about museums, and I'm also talking about a lot of other places.
And there's no delay in that kind of mirroring.
Right.
That would be almost a simultaneous mirroring.
Well, you know, things take time to change, but that my notion of change is that it's a little closer to that reality than it is right now. I see great differences between what's happening, let's say the PMA, and what I see. Or what I see in my multiple sense of reality is what I see outside of that place. There's two different worlds. And that's what I mean.
So would that ideal institution be an institution that you would define as being in flux, or would it have a common core, or would it just be kind of constantly shifting and changing as society shifts and changes?
Well, ideally, constantly shifting. It's a way to create some sort of a sense of barometers what's out there. That's my notion of change.
Okay, a question that I think that all of you are eager to get to, the question of responsibility, or like whether you feel that you have a responsibility or you feel responsible to either a person or a public and another artist, a community, an institution that enables your work. Like maybe for Ken it's an idea, but is this an operative word? Is it a word that has any resonance in your thought, in your process?
Well, I think there's responsibility in the sense of being a citizen of the world. In that sense, that's a responsibility. I don't believe in the responsibility in the sense of I'm owed responsibility to somebody, or I hold responsibility from someone. I don't believe that at all. I think responsibility is it's a, you know, I like the kind of disjunctive aspects of responsibility as opposed to the more defined and conventionalized and assumed ideas of responsibility. I always answer with a dot dot dot. I'm sorry.
Well, as a non-collecting institution committed to the contemporary, we have responsibility to the artists that we show. And I think not only to contextualizing their works in a way that different viewers can enter it, but also perhaps a responsibility to creating a relationship with those artists so that they might move to the next step, so that they might be able to see their own work in a new context and it help them achieve the next thing. I feel a responsibility in presenting contemporary art to try and widen the boundaries, widen the circle of people who want to engage with contemporary art. I mean, certainly something like the projects that I worked with in Visual Aids too take on a difficult sense of responsibility when you're someone's estate manager, when you're kind of keeping a record of an artist who's been lost, who's died from AIDS, or working with the estate of somebody who's died from AIDS. And that can be a paralyzing responsibility as well. So, you know, there's lots of sides to that.
Paul, if you forgive me, I, I, I think I can answer the question a little bit better now. Sorry, I was on a jet plane from Europe yesterday. I would say that I feel responsibility in the sense of theorizing my being, my life, which is short. Life is short. I feel responsibility for theorizing where I the soup in which I'm immersed in, and the and then making observations about it in a very critical, real way, and especially those under-theorized, unspoken, unacknowledged signifiers that circulate about, and very seldom see the light of day, and that's responsibility.
So, because of the nature of my practice and my work, it's often so personal. I always say that the more that I think it's about the others, it's really about me. And so I have a responsibility to myself. I trust that the people that I work with can take care of themselves. But what I'm interested in is more accountability than anything else. You know, I'm really very cautious about how the work is represented. To what extent do I stretch the aesthetics and also the social implications of the installations in a way that I feel that I have a sense of accountability to that notion, and in many ways it is what Ken is saying for me. It's basically very similar that I feel that I'm responsible for my own being. But I trust that people are responsible for themselves as well. I think that what I do with the work is that I go very specific in stories, translate those the stories visually, and at the same time create like maybe one-tenth of what they are and interpret it in my own way. And so as a way to not so much reflect, not so much show the world out there, but actually be able to show the people that I'm collaborating with a side of themselves that I see, which is a side of myself in many ways. So that there's something about working with communities of origin that I think that I wanted to make it clear that my work develops from working with communities of my own origin. So that creates a completely different set of responsibilities in that set. I hope I'm making this clear, but yeah. And distinctively separate from other conversations where you're able to move back and look at the work that is somehow generalized, my work is very, very intense on a personal level.
I want to stay with this question a little bit, or at least this conversation, but broaden it to include the term failure. Have you ever made a work that failed? Have you ever made a work that succeeded? We ask this in developing these questions. We ask this because one of our colleagues here, Kajra Silverman, she suggested that there are no failures. And so I guess I'm interested in that, again, you've all been speaking to this, but if you could further elaborate on the criteria with which you structure your work and your process.
I can start. What fails is the process for me. The process is the one that I'm most cautious about. Installation is secondary. Sometimes I just work and I don't think necessarily about the translation of the artwork because I know I'm really good at that stuff and I can just get it done and present it. But the process is sometimes for me where I think that I have failed or not, you know, in the process of making the work. And I failed a lot, you know, a lot. And so going back again to the sense of responsibility, I just feel that somehow I can make the translation, but then what happens afterwards when the work is already done, I have to pick up wherever that process ended. Because it somehow it's a residue, it's like a debris or a testimony of the process. And so I created 7 installations for a CAB project in New York in the South Bronx, and that was an incredible failure because I had not calculated the social implications of that work. And so that's a failure right there. It succeeded because it was visually stimulating, but the social implications of it didn't match what was going on with the work. Similar to that, and I think that I can predict now that I have a little bit more experience with the process, I can predict now where the projects are going to fail or not halfway through the process. Yeah, I already know. And then, then it's a question of manipulation. How to manipulate this thing to make it work, right? And so, yeah.
The question of failure has a, have you ever stopped beating your wife quality to it? So it's a bit, I would say, I guess I would agree with Kaja. I don't think I've ever failed. I've made work that probably weren't very good. And I've made some works that were good, but every work I've ever made, I thought was necessary. So I don't see it as a failure in those terms. I think I've been failed, right? Or others have failed me. Something that sounds maybe very moralistic, but others have failed me, and certain things have failed me at certain times, and no doubt in that larger sense, I failed others as well. But in terms of my own work, I don't think I've ever failed. I've made work that I look back and I think, yeah, that wasn't very good at all. But I don't think it failed.
So when you applied to Pew Center for Arts and Heritage for Monuments Lab, how do you answer that question that all of us are constantly asked to answer, which is, like, what would it mean for Monuments Lab to succeed?
Right, it's singular, by the way, Monument Lab.
Monument Lab.
What we're trying to do with that project is to give some sort of theory in terms of at least how we, the principals of the project, see Philadelphia at this time with respect to the future. And so we could fail in terms of others and so on, right? But the question was, have I ever failed, right? And I think, I don't know how to answer that question. It hadn't happened yet, hasn't happened yet in terms of Monument Lab. So I can only think in terms of, there was a show called Failure at New Museum in the early or mid 80s. Mm-hmm. But the argument was a little bit, paradoxical. The failure was interesting. It was always interesting failures, and the failure was threw doubt into the definition of failure, and so on. So, and I think if as an artist you take, life is short, but to be an artist you have to take a long road. So that's another kind of paradox, and that road means there's lots of potholes. We're in the pothole season, so I'm going to use that, right? So and it means being able to change that tire, to stretch out that example, or to pick yourself up. And I realized that in terms of being an artist, of course you have to make art, right? But at the same time, you have to think of being an artist as leading the life of an artist and then dying as an artist. And that's a different question from, giving me 5 good years or as an artist and so on. So being an artist is knowing how to remain true to yourself, to make art, to maintain some sort of idealism of art, knowing that there's all these compromising aspects to the reality of the art system, which is actually, which I don't actually have any subscription to or even believe all that much, even though I know that I could have, if I believed more, or even fake believing more, I probably would be in a stronger position in a funny way, but I can't. I am who I am. So I don't think failure is something to be feared. So that's why I don't trust the question.
Well, and I guess just to append onto that and think about what Kaja's saying is it's really what you do with failure is whether it defines or not, because it does seem like a very finite thing to say, like, I just failed, or I'm a failure, or that whole thing was a failure. And I guess in terms of the different types of projects I've done in as being an arts organization director, it's often you're balancing so many different things. You're doing live events, you're commissioning work that you've never seen before, you're fundraising for things at the same time you're paying for things. And so there's a high potential all the time for it to just fall apart. And one of the biggest failures that one can imagine, I think in my position, is that you make something and there's no response. Like, it's just a, you know, there's like a drop in the well, there's no echo, there's no ripple, there's no critical dialogue, that or that it's extremely boring. And these are things that you realize afterwards. I think, like, the kinds of relationships that I make on behalf of my organizations, funding relationships, creative partnerships, those can also end up in ways through hindsight that, you know, badly derailed the organization or misrepresented our mission. And that keeps you awake at night.
There's no trickle, but sometimes 10 years from now, people go, hey, you know what, that was actually interesting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, and I mean, I think that we should be able to have, like, a really long arc in terms of what's important. And it takes time, I think, to develop that critical dialogue. There's certainly things that we see that ICA did, you know, 40 years ago that probably didn't have a very big audience, and I'm sure there were tons of people who said it was extremely boring, but now it becomes these really generative for artists now and for people thinking about art in the present moment. So, you know, I think the responsibility of documenting and the responsibility of making that available for a kind of conversation that might happen, like, way, way, way in the future is important.
So maybe staying with that discussion of funding and economy. So I'm interested in what role funding plays in your creative processes. And I know that all of us are doing many different projects, many different activities. But would you do the project if the funding didn't come through? At Slot and Art Blog, we kind of exist in some kind of odd world where, regardless of what happens with funding, we're committed to the project. How do you guys navigate, you know, the realities of this being kind of a late capitalist society and your projects not just being reduced to funder-driven realities?
So funding relates to, funding equals to me materials, right? And so then there is this whole process that takes place that doesn't require funding. And I think that's where I'm at in terms of, I'm also been questioning a lot whether do I need another exhibition in my lifetime and can I live without an exhibition, like, from now on? And these are questions that are really pounding on my head over and over again, you know. And so I could conceivably, because of the complexity of my installations, work without funding by just doing exhibitions. Process. And at times, I question whether that is a little bit more interesting and important right now than the actual installation.
Well, I don't, you know, whatever project I try to initiate, if I don't receive funding for it, it doesn't arrest me from trying to do the project. In the past, I've always had a job. I have a job now. I'm taking a job, so I don't have to be at the mercy of funding necessarily or sales, right? That's a good thing about having a job, and it's not a factory job. It's a job of where you exercise the mind and so on. So I feel lucky, but I don't think funding is, of course, if I apply for grants, but I don't always get it. But I'm also skeptical of funding as well. I've done a lot of projects. I started a gallery, which is still there in Vancouver. It's funded to a large degree now, but when I started, it was all my own money. I started a journal, which is probably the most important academic journal in China, and gratis, worked 4 years for it, because, you know, it was worth it to me. I managed to show about African decolonization, right, where I did a lot of research in West Africa, in places like, you know, Bamako, Ouagadougou, and, Senegal, and so on. and Dakar, and because I was interested in these sorts of projects, and but they didn't. And I don't come from a wealthy background at all. I come from quite an abjectly poor one, and so, but I found ways to, you know, be able to get a plane ticket. And I find that if you start doing projects that are interesting, you do them well, then you have contacts that lead to more projects, and they're sympathetic to what you do. They say, you know, I'd like to see you work on this show about Republican art during the First Republic of China after the May 4th, 1919 student rebellion. You know, I would like to, so there was support because they saw that I was serious and I did other things that were interesting in terms of Africa and other places, and that I didn't just make, and those were projects where I wrote long essays and so on. So, you know, if you build up a kind of a record, you get a lot of support. And so that's more important to me than the question of whether I get funding or not.
So funding for me, it creates a comfortable place, right? And I'm undeniable that's what it is. Working in this new project, Reform, with Temple Contemporary, I was committed to do the process of it. And so whether we got the funding or not, I was committed from the very beginning, and I talked to the director, Robert Blackson, that I was very committed to get to the place where I delivered what I thought was real life and real people. And so there was no way I was going to approach this project because school closing was very real for the people that we're working with. And so there was no way that I would turn around and say, oh, we didn't get any funding. Okay, thank you guys, take care. So that had to be talking about responsibility and commitment and accountability. That had to be laid out at the very, very beginning of it. So the process was gonna go through, except that the installation itself might not have happened because those are materials and physical things that you have to account for. And so it's a tricky situation. But I'm committing to things that I feel that, and this is what I meant by the process, that I'm committed to the process of it and wherever that takes me. And then this other thing, which is the installation and the visual translation of it, which was to some people I'm mostly known for, that can wait. That part can wait.
And okay, I just want to say that I'm doing a lot of public art commissions, and some of them. I would say, frankly, that probably not that interesting as a project. There's one that's really not that interesting. But I thought it was a good idea for it. I thought I had a good idea, you know, because sometimes you make the most of a situation. And the reason why I pursued it was because I thought, you know, if I win this, because I thought the odds of me winning it with this idea were high, I could make a lot of money, not because I just want to make a lot of money, but because it would enable me in terms of this other project. I could actually take some of that money and put it into Monument Lab, for example, which is what I'm doing. And I did win it.
So Amy, how does this conversation that we're having on the level of art making translate to an institutional context?
Because it's a different story, obviously. My role at ICA as the director, or my role at Visual Aids as the director is, and I think my role in the presentation, working with artists, making art public, is about creating like some structured possibilities so that other people can do like more impossible things or something sort of rational about what we do so other people can explore on an irrational level. And my job is to represent correctly to funders what we are and what we're not going to do and like what our expectation is, which is to either provide space and time for the curators to do this research and follow up on questions and come to dead ends, or for an artist to step out further than they have before, and we don't know what that's going to be. And I think funding is vast. It runs from, you know, community-based grassroots funding for lots of projects to really large grants that are complicated and have all these monitoring to philanthropists who need to have individual donors who really want to direct your program to a donor who's completely hands-off and just says, you know, I'm giving you this money, the dream donor, I'm giving you this money because I believe in what you do and keep doing it, and I don't need to know, you know, I don't need to tell you how to do what you do. So I think that the role of the director is, in some ways, we do have to push back on some of the ways in which funding, and we're talking about like nonprofit foundation and corporate funding, because, you know, this being America, that's what nonprofits run on, to push back on some of the turn towards really holding, say, cultural institutions to this kind of matrix of evaluation that's set up for profit-based corporations. And I mean, it's very encouraging to hear someone like Darren Walker, who's the current president of the Ford Foundation, the second largest foundation in the US, say that, you know, it's completely against the idea of increasing democracy to push cultural institutions to report on this return on investment, which we certainly see as kind of this growing model of how cultural institutions are being evaluated, and that we, as, you know, I think arts administrators, arts workers, really have to push back and to say, you know, we're not going to we're just not going to justify our organizations and the work of artists and the work of connecting viewers with artworks and ideas along those lines. That said, it's, you know, it depends on the size of your organization and where you are with what you can really commit. It's been my position that you have to set a program and then you have to devote, you know, your unrestricted funding or your project funding, whatever it is, once you agree to that project, or you can't make any plans and the participants and the artists and the program isn't going to be fulfilled. So if you have to cut into your reserve, you cut into your reserve if funding doesn't come through.
So. I had a question about public art. 2 years back, I'd spent a lot of time in the former Soviet bloc and in a cultural exchange program. And as I traveled through Bosnia and Serbia and elsewhere, I was shocked to see that all the cultural institutions had closed. The national museums had kind of chains on their doors. The small institutions had closed. And this had happened for a number of reasons. One, the state had kind of swerved to the far right and wanted to defund, you know, cultural institutions. Two, private philanthropies had moved elsewhere. Soros had kind of stopped funding culture in the area. And not to create a correlation between there and here, but I see something somewhat similar happening where there's really a rush to kind of support public art, but in what I consider to be maybe pseudo-populist ways, like for instance 30th Street as the site for cultural practice. Not necessarily the institution, but kind of official sites, official kind of civic sites. And so I'm thinking of, let's say, Pepón's work that has always privileged the house, the barbershop, kind of very intimate spaces, not just official spaces, not just official civic spaces. I was wondering if we could talk a bit about how you guys see the landscape right now, and do you disagree with me? Is there like a rush and a mania for public art? And Ken, I know you've taken a different direction. It's City Hall that is your site. So could you talk a little bit about the role that you see public art having today in our society?
Well, I think public space is becoming so territorialized that it's becomes an issue of whether it even exists properly, right? And so, paradoxically, that actually spurs a lot of interest in public art, right? And probably abetted by the what we were talking about earlier in terms of the skepticism towards museums or institutions and whatever. I don't have it to that degree, but I understand it, right? And so, I don't think Philadelphia is all that unique, to be honest. I think you know, there's not just a propensity of public art interest, but also in terms of memorial building, memorialization, and so on. So the two are going in hand like crazy. And to me, that reminds me of you name it. You could say the Bourbon Restoration or the Second Empire of France, and this doubt among the state about its own last perpetuity. And in order to compensate for that doubt, the commissioning of endless amounts of art. And I think that's more the function going on right now. And as a result, there's a lot of art that's not so interesting, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, all public art is in dialogue with all other art. And, you know, I think about André Breton riding on a double-decker bus and kind of getting and seeing all these decapitated heads, and they were not really decapitated, they were just the heads of the statues that he saw on the second level of a bus. And then, and that actually sparked a lot of theories he had in terms of surrealism and so on. So, sorry, it's a kind of a non-sequitur response, but it's my nature. But I don't think it's unique to Philadelphia at all. I think it's a kind of a symptom everywhere. There's public art competitions going on everywhere, and often it's to reactivate, a kind of decaying mm-hmm. precinct. It's to promote branding strategies. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's Des Moines or Taipei, it's everywhere, right? And so I think as a critical thinking artist, you know, we have to be involved in that.
I don't have much to say. But I am concerned about the use of public space and the lack of public of critical discourse. That I see that there is a pattern of it happening at least in many places. And I'm concerned about that. And that's it.
Do you want to say anything about kind of why you've always located so much of your work in more intimate spaces that are less, maybe not, so to speak, official? Although you've exhibited and all of this, but used particular spaces, the home, for instance, the barbershop,
right.
as I mentioned.
I have always been interested in private conversations in private spaces and public conversations in public spaces. And so the majority of the time, I'm very intrigued by creating a work in together with the people of any given neighborhood and allowing that conversation to be extremely private and indoor and opened up in many ways, but really let and focus on the privacy of it and what it means to that very specific neighborhood. When it goes to the museum, then it becomes a little bit more of a public statement, but totally out of context as well. And so I like the notion of occupying, as you were talking about, and how artists and some artists are really being extremely aggressive with the approach to spaces and occupying spaces, private spaces, to create some sort of a public announcement of social issues. I'm more interested in that approach than anything else. But yeah.
I think when I was talking about occupying too, I'm talking about us, like the viewers and the participants of occupying that space. Mm-hmm. Because we know that public art, or we know that art in general, globally, moves ahead into spaces that are controlled and regulated that we aren't supposed to occupy. So in the most extreme situation, right when Furia Yeridici is curating the Istanbul Biennial, and everything starts happening in Taksim Square, in the parks, and the government says, like, well, number one, Turkey doesn't have public space, it's all administrative space, but the government's like, you can't gather in the parks, you can't show up in a group and be there. So she and her team move what was cited publicly, a biennial and a group exhibition, into spaces, private spaces, because they won't take the special treatment that the government is offering arts groups. So, you know, I think, like, when we think of all the public art competitions and all these things, we have to keep this in mind But at the same time, I think like artists can make really interesting creative interventions, and also with the history of public monuments, as your Breton story relates, like there's a really interesting way to subvert that. But it has to do also with how we participate.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a really good pairing of public art, the two greatest pairing of public art. Which are my favorites in Philadelphia, is Government of the People by Jacques Lipschitz. It looks like an atomic bomb, and it's on the municipal building plaza behind City Hall. And it's a family actually, and they're holding up the Philadelphia Constitution, but they're completely like burdened. It gets heavier and heavier as you go up. It really does look like a mushroom cloud, and it's quite agonizing to look at. And then, but it's kind of only half of what makes it great. The other half is actually not by the same artist, but it's a bronze of Frank Rizzo doing his Hitler salute on the steps of the municipal building. And that pairing, to me, is like the greatest distillation of what Philadelphia is.
Not considered a work of art per se, but I enjoyed, and going back again to what you mentioned about the Casita, I really enjoy when people just take over public land and then negotiate afterwards. And I've seen that happen a lot. And I often wonder, and this is what I mean by the critical discourse, I often wonder why artists just don't just take over public land and then figure out later, negotiate that later. So, yeah.
Okay, one final question, and then I will hand over the mic. So, I want to close with a question about collaboration, which is so important to each of us in different ways. At Slot, we have a very productive kind of ambiguity and ambivalence almost about how to make decisions. Sometimes we act in a horizontal manner, sometimes in a vertical manner. Sometimes we act collaboratively, sometimes unilaterally. So I'm interested in if you could just reflect on how you guys make decisions, how you collaborate, and then also if there can be a true collaboration between unequal parties.
Your questions are so hard. I don't collaborate. because I always, the question always implies that you know, there's a kind of acknowledgement of a distribution of authorship, and I'm the author of my work. I don't give that up. I work with others, and in that sense, and in the spirit of collaboration, with the full knowledge that my partners understand this is my work of art, in that sense, but I don't collaborate in the sense of, you know, ceding any of the final decision-making or authorship to the people I work with.
At ICA, we certainly have been working to create more partnerships with other cultural institutions, some of which are much smaller than ICA. So is that equal or unequal? I mean, we do try and look at it in terms of like how much money goes in with sort of a percentage of the partnership. But the way that it works best really is for both organizations in any project to, and I think this is true with people, that really state what they can and can't do and what they're looking for out of the collaboration. And so then if somebody asks you to do something that's going to go beyond what your institution really needs, then you'll say that. And at least from there, you can get into something productive.
And what about internal to the institution?
Not like just how we make decisions as a team, like as a group of people?
Yeah, how you make a decision in your process.
You should ask G, who's here and working for ICA now in a part-time capacity, how decisions are made in the programming team, like how we decide about how things are done on our public events. But I think the way that I like to work is certainly to give autonomy to the people whose projects there are and in the different departments at the institution. And really my goal is to support them, to provide them with the resources and the support that they can do their jobs. And that has, I think I have directorial concerns that I want to be represented across the museum, and at the same time, you have to cede that control and let people try their own way and appreciate them for their expertise. And I think that's a similar relationship that we have to artists, and hopefully a similar relationship that we have to viewers too, that people can bring their own understanding to the work that we're showing, that they can agree or disagree with our curatorial principles, or they can agree or disagree with readings and criticisms of the works. Just say no.
It's so freaking complicated. Because I think that I collaborate a lot, and but at the end of the day, the my studio becomes a repository of the installation, right? And so I know you don't want to talk about specific projects, but I have to bring Reform into the conversation. So there's a core group that is composed of the principal of the school, the former principal, parents from around the neighborhood, former members of the school reform commission, two of them, community activist, and one student that was a former art teacher in that place, in the school. Then there's another group which is called the Bobcats. The Bobcats are the mascot of the school, and that's 12 kids that we're meeting on Saturdays all the time to talk about the project. And then there's another, you know, there's like four different sort of like units going on at the same time. And I'm collaborating with all of them, and all of them have serious demands and expectations of the project, right? And so my collaboration is just basically right now, it's about interpreting what they see and making sure that what they see somehow it's transparent and it comes into the process. And then it ripples into the core group, Bobcats, and everybody else who's involved. So it's extremely, extremely complicated. I think that for me, it's about choreographing this process in order to create a balance where at the end, people see the process itself in the installation. And to me, that's the most difficult thing to do, and I have been really good at making it happen. But at the end of the day, this is the first time that I'm working in a process where there's a process, there's an exhibition period, and in that exhibition period, the process comes back and people take over the installation. And I've never done this before, but it's quite interesting because people are participating in something that they're investing themselves, and then the art somehow, for me, it's a priority, and it should be at the center, but for people, they see something else beyond the art. And then there is this really interesting sort of orbits going on, and system going on. And that's I think that why make it simple when it can be really complicated, for me, it's the motto of this process. It's like, I want it to be so complicated that people at the end will turn around and say, like, we're in the middle of this mess. How do we get out of it? And so that's basically what collaboration is for me. And it's creating somehow a leverage and agency at the same time for all these people that are involved.